It may seem impossible that our insect populations can thrive in the weather extremes that we have here in Wisconsin. I bet a lot of us wish we were as well adapted to both cold and heat as they are. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week. Glad you could join us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and he recently retired just a couple weeks ago as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, great to see you.
Nice to be here.
And happy retirement.
Yeah, I'm still adjusting, but it's a nice adjustment.
But you're giving it your best shot,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Well, we have a lot to talk about as always, and I know that our listeners love joining in. So let me give the phone number right away. It's 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post a photo, a question, or a comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, Phil, it looks like we're starting to see, I'm afraid to say the start of spring, but maybe the end of winter, at least the last few gasps. Do you expect to see any lasting impact on Wisconsin's insect population after such a severe winter?
Not as much. I think I'm more worried about plant material and how that's going to be affected. So many of my insects are spending the winter in the ground or underneath snow cover, so they didn't really experience the extremes. So there's a couple things. I wonder if the praying mantids that have been breeding in the state, because their egg masses are susceptible to freezing, they might be knocked back a little bit. But it's really very few things. And so overall, what typically affects insects more is how the spring progresses. Mm-hmm. If you really get warm and wake everybody up and then you get real cold, then you have a lot of mortality. But if they're still in their dormant state, really these kind of extremes don't affect them very much.
Hmm. And so those mantids, if I remember correctly from when you've talked about them before, are we kind of on the edge of their zone?
Well, yes. When I first started, the only time we'd see mantids come in is on nursery stock that came in from down south, and they could get through the summer, but when they laid their egg cases, they'd freeze out, and so we'd have no breeding populations. But definitely in the last 10 years, both in Iowa and Wisconsin, we know that they have been strong breeding populations, particularly of the Chinese mantid. But we also have European mantid. There are no native mantids in the Midwest, so these are both technically exotics, but they were breeding here. And so he said, I'm just a little curious because it was kind of the winter I used to grow up with when they couldn't establish here. And I just wonder if that, again, may have affected a lot of the egg cases.
Well, the snow is overall melting, although I know some of our listeners up north are supposed to get like a foot of snow or something today. But warmer weather is sure to arrive eventually. When should we expect our first mosquitoes?
So this is an interesting one. We have 54 valid species of mosquitoes in the state. I will tell you, I have seen mosquitoes in January, and the mosquitoes that you see at the first warm-up day are the species that overwinter as adults, which are not the dominant mosquitoes. So technically speaking, you get a sunny 55-degree day, you can find mosquitoes outside. But as far as the waves of mosquitoes that give us the most problem, those are either from a group we call the snowmelt mosquitoes or the summer floodwater mosquitoes. And in both cases, those are eggs right now that are kind of frozen. So until things finally warm up enough that we've got water and, they can develop. And so normally what I tend to see is the wave will be somewhere around Memorial Day. In a very warm spring, it could be a few days early. In a very cool spring, it might even be delayed a few days late. But if I had to pick the kind of time when you expect it to come on, that would be it.
All right. And what about those other favorites, ticks and fleas?
Well, fleas, the main flea that we have indoors is a cat flea, and so it's living in an environment that is not. And although you can find them on possums and raccoons, and so there are ways that your animals can get exposed to them from wild animals. Because they're in the nests of these animals and the like, I don't see much winter effect there. Ticks, I've been a little confused because I've got a lot of inquiries about this winter killing the ticks off, and I don't know what science would support that. As I said, I consider that they're definitely down in the leaf litter and then the snow cover on top of it, so I think they're well insulated. And so, as I said, I'm not sure where that theory is coming from, but I have not been able to see anything in my career. you know, we were surprised last year because I did see the drought have a major impact, especially on deer ticks back in the late 80s, early 90s. And so we were somewhat expecting that here, and that's not the case at all. I mean, it turned out the tick populations were really very strong. And so I'm a little confused. I don't know if I really totally understand everything about tick biology, but I'll definitely tell you winters I don't see having any effect.
Maybe you retired too early.
Well, you know, the thing that you find in any of these things is that the longer you look at it, the more confusing
sure.
it gets.
So. Sure. And just to recap something that you did cover in depth one or two times ago that you were on the show, but because people have been seeing it, I think, in different articles, is that you do not expect there to be any decrease in the emerald ash borer as a result of the cold weather.
Well, the only place we might catch a break is up in Superior. I mean, because the critical temperature is minus 30. And then really you can maintain that. That really is very tough on them.
And that's real temperature, not wind chill.
Right, right. And so, as I said, in the far north, we may have, you know, and we're somewhat crossing our fingers because that population is very isolated and it would be definitely nice to slow that one down. But in the southern part of the state, we just didn't experience cold enough. And so, you know, you can expect 20-30% mortality, but that's not that unusual and that's not the kind of level of mortality you need to control insect populations.
We're talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and he recently retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Aaron in Potosi. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I have a friend that I'd never heard of these before, but he's got an infestation of bird mites in his home, and they said, like, the only way to really get rid of them is to burn the place down, basically.
Okay.
Is that true?
And no.
There's fencing options and things like that, but he said they're really tough to get rid of in an older home like his.
All right, don't light that match yet.
So one of the things that I see, I mean, bird mites are a potential problem, but it's a very seasonal problem because their preferred hosts are birds. And so I generally see the bird mite season goes from, let's say, end of May to last year. Surprisingly, it went until about the 1st of October. But where the confusion comes is that there are websites that suggest exactly as you say, they're impossible to get rid of. But the reality is that bird mites, when they don't have birds to be around, die in a matter of a few days at best. They do not live on people. And so these claims that they infest houses and you just can't get rid of them are not true. Now, what happens when you have a bird mite infestation is the bird mites migrate off the nest, particularly when the young birds have left. That's where you possibly can get bothered, and they will bite you and leave reactions. But as I said, without the proper host, they're dead in a very short period of time. When you have those infestations, the most important thing is to find the bird nest and get rid of it. But an old bird nest sitting in somebody's attic right now, there's no way it could support it. Plus, it's too cold for anything to move. And so, as I said, when people claim, and we always ask them to send samples in of what they suspect are bird mites. But when I hear about bird mites in the winter, it just does not happen in this climate.
Okay. All right. Does that help, Aaron?
What might it be if he came in with bites on him 2 weeks ago? What might that be?
Well, you know, the first place I would go is either human bed bug, or there is a species associated with bats called a bat bed bug. There also is a fur mite associated with pets. Fleas are another possibility. But then the other complication is that things that look like bites are not truly insect bites. There's other reactions. And so, you know, it's well worth looking for critters running around, but it's easy in this climate to eliminate a whole bunch of things. But as I said, the ones I mentioned, possibilities, but ultimately he's going to have to catch a critter so somebody can take a look at it. And then I always suggest in these cases, if you've got these mysterious skin reactions, then it's worth going to see a dermatologist or somebody to see if they can help work it up. Because ultimately, some cases, they even have to do biopsies of the lesions to figure out what's going on.
All right. Good luck with that, Aaron, and hope your friend can solve the mystery. That brings up a good question, though. Is there anything at this time of year, Phil, that we might be seeing insects indoors that we might not want to be seeing indoors?
Well, one of the things it's quite common to get calls right now about ants waking up. And anytime you see an ant in the house at this time of the year with this kind of weather, you know that they're nesting someplace that's warm. So carpenter ants in particular, this is a common time of the year also. There's an ant we call citronella or yellow ants that they don't come in your kitchen, but at this time of the year, they sometimes swarm, especially if the soil underneath your foundation is warm and they're all mixed up because they think it's spring. The unique thing about it, as the name implies, if you crush these, they smell like lemon pledge. I mean, there's a very pleasant odor to them. And, you know, the old secret with ant control is you tell people you find the nest and kill the queen. Well, you're not going to find the nest here because it's in the ground. So then you start to look at where they squeeze in through and can you caulk it or seal it and stop it. I don't even think spraying gets you very far. I think you probably do as good a job with a shop vac of getting the wing forms when they come out. And it's only a 2 or 3 day experience, and then they seem to disappear. So,
all right. And Audrey says in an email, I have not seen box elder bugs in my house for months, but drat, they're back. Help.
Okay. So it was a quiet year in this past year compared to the year previous, because box elder bugs tend to thrive under very dry conditions. And the unique thing about 2012 is that we had an extra generation. It was such a long growing season. Mm. So what goes on is they're sneaking in September and early October into your wall voids. If it stays cold, they can't move. But when it starts to warm up, and you can get a sunny day that's only 10 degrees outside, but with no wind, you know, in an intense sun, the walls are warming up enough that they're waking up, and now they're trying to find their way out. And that's why you get the problem. And
so they actually come indoors to hibernate, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
And so where you have to draw the line in the sand is in the fall, not now. I mean, now there is just no magic to this because they're not accessible. So we either try to find out where they're squeezing in and get that sealed, which is the more permanent solution. Or if you've had a history of box elder bugs and you can't seal things up, then the option is to kill them outside, whether with a soapy water spray or a number of insecticides. But it's all about that early September is where you win or lose this situation.
So you really need to stop them before they get indoors.
Right. And as I said, last year probably was a little bit confusing to people because they probably didn't see the large clusters that they saw the year previous. So you didn't think there was any box elder bugs out there. But there is always box elder bugs out there to one degree or another.
One thing you can count on, right?
Yes.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and recently retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. Are you having trouble with any particular types of insects indoors? Or maybe you have an insect that you'd like Phil to help to identify. If you have a photo, put it on the Facebook page, and Phil will take a look. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today. We're talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri about the fascinating world of insects. And Phil, why don't we go back to the phones and Norman in Wausau. Hi, Norman.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Phil, I was going to ask you, what is the best way to deal with what I assume are cane borers on raspberry shoots? What happens in the spring, the shoots get new shoots get about 6 to 15 inches high, and there's a double little line around them, and the top above that wilts.
Mm-hmm. Really, the best thing is to prune about 3 inches below that, because what you're doing is removing the critters before they get a chance to mature. So it's usually something that the sanitation aspect is the best. There's a couple other cane borers you get in raspberries, and under extreme conditions, sometimes people will spray for them. But the trouble is you got to know what species you've got, and you have to have the timing right. And as I said, for most of them, it turns out if you can prune and destroy the infected shoots, that should keep you ahead of the game.
And is there anything you can do preventively to keep them off the canes?
Well, again, that comes into timing your insecticide application when the adults are coming in and doing their thing. In this case, those little rings are the female is literally putting her egg-laying device in there and then laying the egg, which for that particular species seems to be necessary for them to be successful. Some of the other cane borers get farther down in the base of the plant, and then it gets a little bit more subtle, but you get a much bigger wilting on the plant. Mm-hmm. And anytime you see wilting on shoots like that, I think it's well worth taking a penknife, cutting it open to see if there's any sign of insects. If you can't find insects, then you get more suspicious of root rots and other diseases in those plants.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck with that, Norman. And let's go next to Al in Land O'Lakes. Hi, Al.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Philly, thanks for all the years of making me feel better about sharing the North Woods with ticks. I've been using, I've listened to your shows and I've been treating my clothing with a water-based veterinary flea and tick mist, which has 0.20% pyrethrins, and then it has a piper butanide 0.75 N-oxyl. I can't read the label real good.
Sure. Okay, so you have an organic form of pyrethrin, although the piperio butoxide makes it technically not organic, but a better product. They are
better in the sense of safer or less toxic.
Not toxic, okay. It works better.
Oh, it works better.
The problem with pyrethrin, the natural products, it breaks down in sunlight, so it's really not a long-term solution. So what the chemists have done is made synthetic pyrethroids, and the one that's made as a tick clothing spray is permethrin, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. And in particular, you want to buy the products that are made for spraying clothing. There are similar products made for putting on your dog, but technically the label directs you how you can officially use a product. And what I've had this problem of people going to get the termite version of this chemical, soaking their clothes in it, and then I'm in all kinds of problems because it's got all kinds of carriers and things. And so, as I said, you buy stuff that's made for the purpose. And the permethrin clothing sprays, the synthetic version, if you put it on your work clothes, it will stay there for days. I mean, it's not as if it degrades. And that's the problem with the product you're using now, is it probably within a matter of a couple hours is gone. And the whole issue there is that if the ticks walk on this product, they die. And then you're not going to get sick. And so 100% effective, as I said, it's not like you have to apply it multiple times. If you got a pair of Carhartts that are your work clothes, as I said, until you get them soaking wet, I wouldn't worry about reapplying the product. And if you're concerned about toxicity, this same insecticide is used as a head louse shampoo on people. It's also used as a skin cream for things like scabies infestations. But the particular product that's made for spraying for tick control is only for your clothing. It's not for your skin. You wouldn't want to. So there's no reason to put it on your skin anyway. And best place to find it is sporting goods stores in particular, and not so much at pharmacies. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that if you're an outdoors person, anytime there's no snow on the ground, the ticks can be active and you should consider having this product available.
I had one other question.
Sure.
Did you ever dream that you were in Kafka's novel Metamorphosis?
And for those who have not read it, someone wakes up and has turned into a very large insect.
No. Although, one wonders. I always warn my wife that I'm afraid I'm going to become delusional about insects in my old age, but we'll see about that.
Well, I have to say, I think your old age, retirement is here, but old age is still a ways in the future.
Right.
There. Thanks for that call, Al. Let's go next to Robin in Madison. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay. I have a very strange ant question for you, Phil. Last spring and summer, I noticed, and my family thought I was insane, I noticed ants crawling out of electrical outlets in my house. And not into my kitchen, but into my television, in particular, the DVD box. That is where I was like, wait a minute, where are these ants going? They were going into electrical, like I said, these electrical boxes. I traced them to electrical outlets. Mm-hmm. And I can't seem to find any information on these ants, except I did read an article months ago in the New York Times in the magazine section that wasn't that informative about these kinds of ants. And they even came up with a name for these ants. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. And honestly, the article in the New York Times might have been referring to this new invasive ant down in Texas that's called the raspberry ant, that it's notorious for doing it. Now, that's not up here. At least we haven't seen one yet. But what I suspect is going on, it's probably pavement ants. It could be odorous house ants. We have some species of ants that have multiple nests, and they will move them. And so it's often not unusual to find them in little void protected spaces, which could include the outlets or the DVD player. But they don't necessarily live there all the time. They will move the nests, and that's both makes them somewhat problematic to control. Although what I would suggest is what we need to find out is what their food preference is. And it's either going to be sweet things or it's going to be oil-based and more protein. So take a little cooking oil and take a little honey, put it on a piece of wax paper and put it in an area you've seen some ant activity. Maybe a little more active at night, but once you find out where their food preference is, and believe it or not, there's some ants that will feed on both, then the way you address this is to get baits that are made primarily for the type of ant that you've got. The whole concept of baits, they will pick up whatever the product is and feed it to each other, but more importantly, feed it to the queen. And so for ants that it's hard to find the nest or you have multiple nests, baiting is the best way to go. The better baits, honestly, you probably need to get on the internet. just because they're not as readily marketed at the hardware stores by the companies that make them. But the most important thing is to know what kind of ant. And as I said, you can play this game of seeing where their food preference is, or indeed you can catch an ant and send it down. There is a person, PJ Leash, right now that is running the diagnostic lab. And I'm sure PJ would be happy to take a look at it, because so once you know the species, it kind of opens up the door as far as what's the proper baits and the like. So,
okay, what? How do you feel about that diatomaceous earth? Is that okay to kind of sprinkle around? Like, it was around the baseboards, around these electrical outlets,
right?
Like literally lines of these ants going.
Okay. So diatomaceous earth, if you understand how it works, it has uses. It's an abrasive. And so if you put an insect in an environment where it has to stay in contact with the diatomaceous earth, it will kill them because it rubs off the wax on their outside. So at times people will blow the diatomaceous earth not in the junction box, but the areas around it. So if it's put in a wall, it honestly makes the wall kind of insect-proof, if you think of it that way. But if you put a little bit on your baseboard, if the ants have the option, they can avoid it. And they don't have to walk on it. So, as I said, it has its uses, but it doesn't solve all the problems. In this particular case, as I said, if you're trying to, because in this case, if you kill a few workers, they're sterile females, you really don't affect the population. I think we, again, have to get after the queens. And for this type of ant, I think that's better done with baits. Some of the baits have boric acid in it. Some of them have other things. The interesting thing is most of the things that we use as baits are far less toxic, and we have far more control of how we use them than if you're using sprays. So as I said, I'm really very comfortable with the baits, but the big problem is you got to match the bait or you're not going to have success.
And Phil, I've noticed ants, for instance, at our house really like if they find a little cat, the little cat food pellet kind of thing, that would probably be the protein.
Right. And
protein
in fact,
fat type.
If you were to call me with that question, I would say, I bet you got pavement ants. Because it's a common ant that will stay around. You've got hot water heat. They're even happier with their house than if it's electric heat. But and they love cat food in particular.
Because it's really high protein.
Right. But the interesting thing is, I said, they have multiple queens. It's not a native ant. It's from Europe. In most of these ants that don't belong here, we call tramp ants, and they have this same darn behavior of multiple queens, and you think you got them, and then another nest or activity area comes up. And so they really are a challenge. But if you know what you're doing, you can take care of it. It just takes some persistence.
And Robin said that she definitely saw them going into these electronic things. Might that be because they're warm?
Could be because they're warm, but I think more there's probably a hollow space that they find to their liking. I've heard some conversations that there may be some electrical fields that control or attract certain ants. That seems to be going on with this exotic raspberry ant down in Texas, but I said we haven't seen it here. That one has been amazing. I've talked to pest control people that have dealt with it where they will put treatments on the outside of the house and the ants are 3 inches deep dead in those areas. And of course, then you're not controlling them anymore because the live ants walk over the dead ants, and so they're not getting exposed to the product. So
wow.
It's really posing quite a challenge. I don't think it's warm enough up here for us to ever have to worry about that ant. I've said that about other ants and been surprised because, as I said, we do have a lot of tropical ants that have found living in our buildings is not that much different than being in the tropics.
Talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. I am Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And Phil, we have some things on Facebook to take a look at. First, Josh said that the permethrin insecticide that you just mentioned is highly toxic to cats. And so he said that's good for listeners
right.
to know.
And this is why we preach always to read the label, because if you read any permethrin label, it will state that very clearly. Cats have the sensitivity. And when we talk about pesticides, I always like to tell people, they're like people, they have personalities. And just because a chemical belongs to a certain group, there are certain chemicals that don't get along with certain animals. And as I said, that's why the label. And we find that the most likely person not to read the label are homeowners. You know, farmers tend to be, they know that this is how it goes.
Okay.
And I've seen figures as high as 60% of the use patterns are done without people ever paying any attention to the label. And that just scares me.
That is scary. And Denise posted a photo, a mystery bug seen in September in Milwaukee. And it's kind of a arrowhead shape in a way, green.
So
It looks like it's on maybe a downspout.
This is a type of grasshopper, but we separate grasshoppers into two groups. We have the shorthorn grasshoppers, who are the classic ones people think of, and then we have what we call the longhorn grasshoppers, which have very long antennae. This includes katydids and bush katydids and a number of them. This looks like one of the katydids to me. These are the things that the males at night make this kind of rattly sound up in the trees, and can be quite loud and unfortunately for some people quite disturbing. They're also very territorial, and you will notice that their calling is related to air temperature. So a nice warm late summer night, they're just really active. In a 40-degree night, you don't hear much.
So. There you go. And Tyrone also posted some really great photos. There's a photo of two moths. White and black spotted one on the left, and then one that looks brown
like a spaceship.
Okay. Or an alien that just came out of a spaceship.
So the white spotted one is a type of leopard moth, and honestly, this is related to the woolly bear caterpillars. It's a tiger moth. And the one on the right is one of the sphinx moths. I think this is either the blind sphinx or the one-eyed sphinx. I don't have my books here to verify. And they have this very interesting way of holding their wings that make them just look really exotic, but also makes a great subject for a picture.
And then Tyrone also posted a photo that I couldn't believe we have one of these in Wisconsin because it looks so exotic. It's almost all yellow with beautiful pink highlights.
Sure. So we call this a rosy maple moth.
Rosy maple moth.
And it is in the group of wild silkworms. So this is related to the Cecropia moths and the Polyphemus, but it's a much smaller version. I would say they're kind of uncommon. I mean, if you really do a lot of collecting, you can find them. And sometimes, and once every 7-8 years, you get a little outbreak of them. But generally, they're kind of an innocent little creature. And again, the color patterns are such, you'd almost swear they're tropical.
It's just gorgeous. I mean, it's this butter yellow and this lovely pink. And then Tyrone found all of these moths at Mirror Lake, which is near the Dells. And then there was also a picture that's a little harder to get a sense of it.
And I'm not sure if this is from the group the Noctuids or this is an Oolothyrid. I can't see enough. I mean, I've seen a couple of these referred to as bird dropping moths because this is what we think they're doing is when they hold their wings that way, they look like they're just
so
a
this
bird
is
dropping.
Actually a moth. It's not some kind of larvae.
It's definitely a moth. As I said, I just can't see enough of the patterns, wing patterns and whatnot to tell you what. And you know, what makes moths kind of tough is, you know, we have 150 species of butterflies. We have probably about 4,000 species of moths. So there's so much diversity there. Some of them aren't the easiest things to identify.
All right. Well, thanks for those photos. And if you have a photo of an insect, either one that you want to have identified or just want to share, we'd love to see it on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And you can check out those photos from Tyrone. And I forget who else was that. Denise posted photos there. Let's go back to the phones, and Lloyd in Richfield has a moth question, too. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm annoyed with winter like everyone else. Other than that, you know, it's Wisconsin, so, you know, I've been getting really good at whining. I am a first-class whiner now about winter.
Well, do you have an insect to whine about, Lloyd?
Yes, I certainly do. I have a small white moth that's flying around our house. All over, and you know, you see them around. And I think my wife, I think it's what's called a Miller moth, I am not sure, but we did find some old larvae in some oatmeal, and my wife thought it was that. And of course, we have capped everything and got rid of all of that, but they're still flying around. And the last step, what broke the camel's back was we were having people over for dinner last night, and one of them landed in the pie, which did not make my wife happy, and now she's threatening to run all around the house with some nasty insecticide and spray the world.
Okay. Well, let's see what Phil has to say.
And that won't solve it. So I suspect it's an animal that I would call an Indian meal moth, although there's two or three other species of grain moths that we can run into that would do similar things. And although the infestation may have started with the oatmeal, what these things are notorious for is finding other food sources. And I would define anything that's dried plant material. So aside from the cereals and the nut meats and the raisins and stuff in your cupboards, we're talking dried flower arrangements, potpourri, tea, all kinds of things. And art objects made out of eucalyptus and all kinds of similar types of items. And so it's all about a hunt and destroy. Because if you don't find the infestation source that they've jumped to, you're not going to win. So it's a great idea of putting the normal food products that are infested in basically seal-proof containers like Tupperware. But as I said, if the pattern continues, there's something you've overlooked. And now we're starting to get into this realm of, as I said, is it an art object sitting in your bedroom? Or, you know, when people tell me molds and the moths are in the bathroom, that's not a normal food source, but people have potpourri or dried flowers mm-hmm. or that kind of thing. And so, and that's why I always tell people, you know, if you've got a bad box of Bisquick, you can spray all you want and you still got bugs. And so it really is a sanitation issue. And it can be frustrating. And I've related on the show before that even in our own household, the infestation started in some birdseed in the garage, migrated into the kitchen. We had to throw some noodles and rice out. And then it was about one moth every 2 weeks for months. And of course, my professional credibility was coming into question in the house. And I was just searching everywhere. And, you know, we used to have a parakeet. Well, I looked at the old parakeet cage. I mean, just all these kind of things that may relate. But it will finally trace down to is I had a True Value hardware store bag on the basement shelves that I swore where there were screws or something similar in it. When I opened it up, it was a bunch of vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me years ago, and I forgot about it. And that was the final source of the infestation. So I will tell you, it can be quite frustrating, but it's all about hunting it down. And if you can keep a pattern of where you've seen the most activity, you know, if it's always the kitchen, it's still got to be there. And I have had trouble, you know, in my career when we've had mouse problems where the downed mice will steal the pet food and stash it behind the counters, and then we have a very hard-to-get-to type of food source. But if the pattern is in different rooms, then we start, you know, if it's in the basement, then you got something in a box somewhere that's infested.
All right. So Lloyd should encourage his wife not to run around spraying because it's not going to work anyway.
Right. Definitely.
All right. Thanks for that call, Lloyd. Let's go next to Mary in Heartland. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question on Japanese beetles and raspberries. I've been reluctant to spray them just because I want to eat them.
Sure.
But I don't know if that would help. What do you suggest? When do you spray? How do you spray? I just don't know what to do. Last year I gave up and let them have it. So let the beetles have the raspberries.
Right.
The
biggest problem with Japanese beetle for any of us to deal with is they're not breeding on your property. So there's nothing I can tell you to do magically that will make them go away because they're flying in from down the road. You normally expect the activity to start the last few days of June, and it will carry through till at least the 1st of September. So you have a very extended period of time. The feeding on the leaves, honestly, is more cosmetic than you think. I would tell you that anything below 20% leaf loss is not causing any yield problems. So you can tolerate some of this, but then as far as how you put up the fight, some people will use floating row covers if their patch allows that, so a physical protection. There are numerous products that are registered, some organic, some not, but no matter what the product is, the effectivity is only for 4 or 5 days. So either you have to apply it a number of times and you got to pay attention to the label. Some products will make you wait a couple days before you harvest. Some have no restrictions. It just, again, depends on the product. But again, all you're doing is protecting the plants for that short window, realizing that next year or even 2 weeks from now, it doesn't make much of a difference. And so it is a real challenge. Now, the only thing that I relate to people that has been somewhat interesting to watch is in my own yard, Japanese beetles have been established in our neighborhood for about 15 years. And back about 2002, 2003, it was to the point of everybody in the neighborhood was very upset with me because, you know, there are 300 different species of plants they feed on. And we live about 2 blocks from a golf course, and it's just wave after wave that come in. But the populations lately are about 10% or less of what they've been. And this seems to be the pattern. Given some time, their populations will go. But this is like a 10 or 15 year experience. And so for people like at the Garden Expo, when I was talking to them, that are just getting Japanese beetles for the first couple years, unfortunately, they have got quite a number of years of misery, but it will get better over time. And to the point that, as I said, in my neighborhood, people have stopped treating their birch trees and other things. There's just not enough activity to justify mm-hmm. that.
And Mary, how big a raspberry patch do you have?
Well, I'd say at least, I don't know, 20 feet maybe by 20.
Okay. Well, you know, if you're looking for organic products, two that I would consider. One is called neem oil. And neem oil
is that N-E-E-M?
Right.
Is that right?
And there's various formulations of it, but basically it's derived from a tree that has a seed as a legume tree called the neem tree. And then the other product, the active ingredient is called spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. And it is a insecticide derived from a fungus that grows in the soil. And both those products have some efficacy, but as I said, like anything else, it might mean multiple applications. Both those products are registered for raspberries. I just don't off the top of my head know how many days restriction. Mm-hmm. Neem, probably none. I'm guessing spinosad might have a couple day restriction as far as harvesting berries.
Well, and I was wondering, too, if it's not too large a spot. And, of course, with raspberries, it's hard to reach into the middle, depending on my raspberry patch, at least. I can't really reach into the middle without coming out with war wounds. But also just hand-picking them
right
off.
So one of the things, at least Japanese beetle seems to prefer exposed out in the sun type thing. So they don't really burrow deep into the plants. You tend to find them out on the edges. And if you go in the late afternoon, that's about the time they tend to congregate the most. The research tells us that if you handpick, you're reducing the population on a plant by 50%. So you are gaining on it. But again, more come flying in. So, you know, if you've got it or, you know, if you've got younger children that want to make a couple cents, you know, you might consider
paying by the
beetle. just drop them into, you know, some soapy water or something else. In fact, you notice if you put a container underneath them and you just tap it, their defense behavior is to drop straight in. So you don't even have to touch them all in particular. And do stay away from the traps. I mean, as we've talked about before on the show,
they actually draw them in.
They draw them in and they make them worse. And so it really doesn't, you don't gain anything by putting traps next to your raspberry patch.
Mm-hmm. Good luck with that, Mary. And even if you're not able to put much of a dent in the next year or so, hope is coming a few years out. We're talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Let's go up to Superior and Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, we've been threatened with a possible armyworm movement this year, and we have some fruit trees, and we were thinking of using BT as a control, and we were wondering how that might work and if it would work.
Okay.
And Phil, can you tell us about armyworm caterpillar?
I don't think it's armyworm, because what I call an armyworm is a grass-feeding insect that comes from a moth that flies up here in the spring. So it eats corn and eats wheat and stuff, but it doesn't eat trees. What outbreaks we've had historically up your way is the forest tent caterpillar, and it's primarily a feeder on oaks and on poplar tree, and it doesn't make a tent. So that's the first thing that confuses people. How can it be a tent caterpillar and there's no tent in the trees? And in particular, they will feed on fruit trees also. The worm has a broken white line right down the back, and then it has some kind of pretty blue spotting and some black and a little bit of yellow fuzz. It really is kind of an interesting critter.
And how big are these?
When they're full grown, they're about 2 inches. But right now, what they are egg masses on the trees. And so for some trees, like the fruit trees, if the egg masses were there, you could go out there and literally scrape them off. They're about 3/4 inch in size. They look like a swelling on the twig. And if you look close to them, they're kind of black and foamy looking, but more like styrofoam is the consistency. Now, BT is a stomach poison.
And what does BT...
It's a bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis, and there is a strain of this that's used quite commonly, and it is considered organic, that contains a protein that will literally shut down the insect's digestive system. But it only kills caterpillars. It doesn't kill any other kind of insect, so it's a very selective product. But in order for it to work, the caterpillars must eat it, so you have to wait till the eggs hatch. And I'll tell you, the smaller the worms that feed on it, the better it works. So what you're going to have to figure out is the source of the worms' egg masses on the trees. If that's the case, shortly after you start to get some green leaf tissue growing, you can spray. Or is the source of the worms the tent caterpillars that are on trees adjacent to you and they are crawling to your trees? Then it's going to be a later treatment. And that's where the name armyworm comes from, because when they get those outbreaks, they will defoliate total areas, no trees, leaves left, and then they start marching looking for new food, and that's where you get this incredible, almost science fiction-like experience. And as I said, we've had that your way about 6-7 years ago is the last outbreak of forest tent caterpillar we've had. So it'd be good to have the BT around. As I said, I would examine the trees when the leaves are about a half inch in size, see if there's any sign of activity, because that would be the time you would control those. Whereas if they migrate in, it's kind of a wait and see. But when you start seeing them crawling in the yard, then that's when you're going to have to come and protect the trees.
So how is it that they're giving kind of a prediction that there's going to be an infestation?
Some of the DNR foresters will go through and they're counting egg masses on the poplar trees. So you can go in go in there with the pruners and drop a certain number of larger branches and count the number of egg masses, and that gives you a prediction, because it's kind of a buildup process in most cases, one generation a year. And so if there's no eggs there, we're home free. If they're starting to see a lot of egg masses showing up, then, as I said, then the predictions are pretty easy to make.
All right. Does that help, Dave?
And you would just sort of blanket spray the whole tree, sort of. Would it be something you would put, be able to put on like a hose sprayer?
Yes, the hose sprayer. You know, for a good sized apple tree, it probably takes 2 to 3 gallons of mix to get good coverage. Now, it's probably not as important to get that thorough a coverage for this particular insect versus some of the other fruit insect pests that we've get. A hose end attachment's fine. What you tend to find with that, you're probably going to use quite a bit more product. Because it's a little harder to proportion. So I like that kind of treatment for things you just can't reach any other way, or for things like millipedes and such where we need a lot of volume. But it definitely isn't necessary. If you can find another way of applying it, you know, with a 1 gallon pump sprayer or the like, that would be sufficient too.
All right. Good luck. Good luck with that, Dave. And we are talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He recently retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Lucky for us, he's willing to come back and talk with us about the fascinating world of insects. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking about the fascinating world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist, recently retired, head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Phil, we have a wonderful photo up on the Facebook page. Sarah took a picture of it on a door in New Glarus, and it is a gorgeous dog day cicada, you said.
Yes. And so, you know, there are a number of different species of dog day cicadas throughout the U.S. We have one common one. And we have about another 6 species of cicadas you can find in the state. Now, these shouldn't be confused with the 17-year cicadas, although they're related, and we do have a population in the southeast part of the state. So we have dog day cicadas every year, and one of the things, for whatever reason, they had a good year last year. They were late, but once they got here, they didn't stop until almost the 1st of October, which was kind of fun. So when I was going through my records, I was surprised at the number of pictures people had sent me of dog day cicadas. And as I said, they, for whatever reason, liked something about 2013.
It's a beautiful dark green color with black, and the wings are so intricate. They're basically transparent, but with this wonderful dark green veining through it. Just yes, really beautiful.
And I've seen, artists take this and make little brooches and whatnot of cicadas, and I think it's the same thing. It is both the color, the shape, but in particular is that neat venation on the wings.
And so people that want to see that photo, go to the Larry Mueller Show on Facebook page. That's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And all those photos that are posted by listeners are off in the right-hand corner. I think it says posts by others. But really wonderful. I mean, wonderful photography, too. I mean, the detail is so, so clear. Let's go back to the phones, and Scott in Reedsburg is up next. Hi, Scott.
Hi, I have a question. I'm wondering if you've ever heard of a scabie and if they can be contracted without being around a person. Just maybe.
Sure. So scabies are basically the human form of mange mites, and they live in the skin. They don't bite per se. They cause more of a rash. In particular, you often see them in moist areas of the body, so like between the toes, between the fingers, and the like.
The groin.
Yeah, and they really cannot survive very long off the host. So if somebody had an infested pillow, let's say, and immediately somebody else laid on the pillow, maybe a transmission, but basically it needs close contact. And honestly, it appears that they're not as easily transmitted as some people might think, because you have husband and wives where one is infested, one's not, and the like. But, you know, like we had talked earlier, you know, mysterious bites, mysterious rashes, there's so many things that can cause it. And the only way you can diagnose scabies is a skin scraping. So it's technically a medical procedure. It's something, in fact, we don't do in our lab because it's on person and it's kind of out of bounds for us. And as I said, they do a skin scraping. They find the presence of the mites. They prescribe a cream. You have to be a little careful with washing sheets and whatnot, but that's about the extent of it.
Does that help, Scott?
Yes, and could you get rid of them by putting a permethrin spray on your clothes?
No.
And then wearing your clothes and get rid of them?
No. In particular, what they'll give is permethrin creams for on your body. And one of the things that we're talking to dermatologists about treatments, they tell me people often don't follow the directions as far as thorough enough treatment, because you don't just treat the areas you're seeing symptoms in the like. But as I said, it's something that you got to get by prescription. And so, again, it's something it's best to see a doctor about.
All right. Good luck with that, Scott. Let's go next to Dennis in Little Rice, Wisconsin. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you.
And I hope you have many more years to enjoy it. And my question is, I've heard talk up here, mostly in bars, that the DNR brought in the Asian lady beetle to fight some other exotic.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was not true. Or is there any government body of any sort in Wisconsin that brings in exotics for fighting against other exotics?
Yes. The DNR has, and the Department of Agriculture at times have. But honestly, this is not just their decision. Anything that's brought in that's exotic has to go through federal permits, and the USDA is very tight on what they allow releasing or not. So they have released a couple parasites for the emerald ash borer in recent years. That's probably the most recent one that I'm aware of. Asian lady beetle, it's a complicated story. There were never any Asian lady beetles released in Wisconsin. There was a history of Asian lady beetles being released as early as the 1915s, 1920s in parts of the U.S. Never any evidence of them establishing. The most recent release was back in the early 80s or late 70s down in Georgia. And all of a sudden, this thing showed up in Louisiana in the late 80s. And so even though you'd say, well, yeah, they released them, it's their fault, I can never draw the lines. It seems like it's a separate introduction. So, yes, there are cases, but as I said, it's usually they have to apply for permits. They're going after specific exotics. And what they're trying to do is bring the natural balance you find in the country of origin. So like in Asia, the emerald ash borer is not a pest. And part of it's because the trees have natural resistance, but it also has a complex of parasites that help slow it down. A couple of those parasites have been released to hopefully help us out here. Although I know talking to Dr. Raff in our department, who has worked with this, is presently working with it, there's some concerns that the parasites aren't going to survive the winter because it's been cold enough. So we'll wait and see on their study sites how that goes. So it's not as if somebody can just come up with a wild idea and I'm going to bring this in here. Things maybe worked that way 100 years ago, but not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Dennis.
Clear things up.
Thanks, Dennis. And you can call in at 1-800-642-1234. Jeanette in La Crosse is up next. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. You were talking about cicadas, and I used to love to take the cicadas, the shells that are hanging on the trees when they've gone, mm-hmm. and bring them in the house and hang them on my mother's curtains.
Ah. I'm sure she found that amusing. Well,
I hope she liked it.
I got a number of pictures, again, of cast skins or people that had their camera present when the cicada was coming out of that cast skin and emerging as an adult. So just incredible pictures and the like. And in fact, honestly, I got a picture of that this morning.
Really?
That somebody found in an orchard. Cool. They wanted to know what it was, you know, and kind of walking back. And, you know, and the interesting thing is, you know, that's the classic outside skin of an insect. It's like plastic. It doesn't degrade. You know, what's impressive about this one, it's about an inch long and as big around as your thumb. So it's it's kind of a hefty looking creature. And it looks kind of mean with those digging legs in
it
the
does.
Front. Definitely a harmless creature.
Cool. Well, I have a question that I thought of, too. Can I give
sure.
you two or do I have to pick one?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, the first one is in the summertime, I always see these. It almost looks like those trees that put out that lint and they float around. There's bugs that look like floating fuzz in the air,
mm-hmm.
but then what are those?
The most common one I see is called the woolly alder aphid. And so it's a little aphid that secretes a waxy filament that makes it look like a piece of cotton candy. There are other species of woolly aphids, but the woolly alder aphid has been particularly common in the last few years. And it jumps between alder and maple trees. And, of course, there's maple trees everywhere. And so that would be my first guess.
Hmm. Oh, cool. And then the other question is, when does an insect get so small that it becomes a microorganism?
Does not. You know, insects have these characteristics of three pairs of legs, three body regions, skeleton on the outside. Smallest insects are down around a half a millimeter or so in the adult stage. When you get into microorganisms, their body structure is very different. They don't have legs, they don't have head and the like. And so just by using the characters we use to define these animals is how we separate them out.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeanette. And we had a little follow-up from an earlier call. Someone was saying that they hadn't had box elder bugs in the house for a while, and now they're waking up. Mimi emailed to say she's found that at this time of year, the box elder bugs just want to leave the house. And if she opens a south-facing door or window, they just leave on their own accord.
Yeah, and that's natural. I mean, it's a mistake for them to come indoors, honestly, because the warmth in the early waking up is not a good strategy. It's kind of like they have limited food reserves, and when it's warm, they burn these up. And so you find a lot of the box elder bugs that wake up in January die in a day or two, whereas under natural settings, they wouldn't wake up until two years ago, it would have been about this time when we had 80-degree weather, but
right.
It's going to be until it warms up. And then their whole idea is to crawl back onto the trees when the trees leaf out and lay their eggs, because they're basically a seed feeder on box elder and some maple trees.
And Matt emailed to ask, he says, a beehive living in the ground has already killed one of his dogs. How can he get rid of them, and are they important for pollination?
Okay, probably yellow jacket. So that's a paper wasp. The nests get very big in the late summer, and if you fall into one, it can be really a hair-raising and potentially life-threatening, but they don't survive the winter. So it all starts from scratch. So the best thing to do is if you see activity, and again, in ground nests, old rodent burrows, those kind of things, fill those in the spring so there's no nest for them to start. They don't dig themselves. They got to find a pre-existing cavity.
Oh, okay.
If you see them later in the year and they're active, we use powdered insecticides in late afternoon to kill them off. And you don't want to treat in the middle of the day because the ones that are out and about come back and get very angry, at least in the late afternoon or especially early evening. They're all in there. And as I said, the powders work a lot better in sprays for those kinds of nests.
We are talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri today. He is recently retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this week for Larry Mueller while he is in Hawaii with a bunch of WPR listeners. There'll be a lot more to talk about with Phil right after a quick look at the news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. No matter what the season, there are countless insects around us. And whether we're talking about mosquitoes, moths, box elder bugs, or millipedes, it's always a fascinating and informative conversation. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is our guide to the world of insects. He helps us figure out what we're dealing with and what to do. Phil is a distinguished faculty associate emeritus and recently retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, always such a pleasure to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And as usual, we have full phones, so let's go back to the phones and Shirley in Wautoma. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for taking my call,
sure.
Judith. I'm just thrilled to be able to get through to you and Phil. I've been listening to public radio for a number of years, and I'm always amazed at how much I learn by listening to the radio, and especially Phil with his program and the wealth of breadth of knowledge he has about whatever the kind of insect is. My particular problem is bed bugs. I discovered that we had bed bugs in our bedroom last November, and I have been taking the bed linen and sterilizing them in the dryer for 40 minutes on high, washing them on hot, whatever the combination is, pillows, everything. I've been checking the room thoroughly. I started by using Fabuloso, which seemed to kill the adult bed bugs. But then as I did more research on the internet, I wanted something that was more comprehensive, and I found a product called Hot Shot that supposedly kills the eggs and adults both. Its active ingredient is lambda cyhalothrin.
Mm-hmm.
It's got 0.03% of the active ingredient in that. And I've been doing this weekly since then. Hadn't seen a bug for about 6 weeks in our bedroom, and we'd been vigilant about getting up in the middle of the night to see them if they were around and catching them and spraying them on the wall and in other places. I sprayed the baseboard, I checked our dressers, sprayed wherever I saw anything, checked thoroughly for eggs, but mainly I saw the concentration of eggs underneath our beds. So as I said, I've been flipping the beds weekly and spraying them with this Hot Shot product. However, two nights ago, we saw a bug on the wall. So now I'm calling you if you have any other suggestions you might give me to pursue this.
Sure.
Wow, what a nightmare.
So the first thing is, with your description, when I hear about bed bugs, even though, you know, it depends where it was in my career, up until about 10 years ago when I got the calls, most of the time it was a species associated with bats, which is a very different story, a much easier one to control. I guess my comments about the history of what you use, lambdacyhalothrin has some efficacy, but the biggest reason why we're not winning the war on bed bugs is our chemicals are not working because they have resistance. And so, you know, in low populations, it possibly could control, but I'm not surprised that it's not picking things up totally for you. And, you know, all the physical things you're doing, but the problem is if bed bugs are back in walls and other things, they're not very accessible. You know, people have used steam heat and other things. In certain cases, they've used mattress encasements, which is a way of, you know, I hate to see people throw things out because that often doesn't solve anything. But I guess I would say for most people, even though it is pricey, it is worth getting somebody professionally coming in because this is just such a complicated thing. And I know people are desperate. I know my neighbor told me he's a volunteer firefighter, and he just was in on a call where somebody read on the internet that alcohol kills him. And it's true. If I have a bed bug in front of me and I put alcohol on, I can kill him. This person was sprinkling alcohol all around the room, and it got next to a light fixture, and it set the house on fire.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's one of the things we're finding is people that are trying various remedies are often and many times causing, you know, pesticide contaminations, all kinds of things. And so for this case, as I said, I think you've put up the fight and it, you know, you've gained on it, but you haven't won. I would consider getting somebody to come in professionally and see. And, you know, you can get a couple, three people coming in and get various opinions. In some cases, I'll try to oversell things, but for the most part, I find they're very respectful. The ultimate treatment for bed bugs that works is heat. You know, where they come in with these giant heaters and they generate 140 degrees ambient air temperature when we cook them out. So it's very similar to what you're doing in the dryer. But by putting it in the bedroom, they can heat everything up so that the bed frame, the dressers, everything are warm enough that it will kill bed bugs.
And there's nowhere for them to hide.
Right. The problem with that treatment is it's expensive. You know, and so again, it's kind of an assessment. If they've only been in the bedroom and there's no chance that you've moved them to the couch with pillows and other things, then you just need to treat the bedroom. If you have a large house and they've infested a number of rooms, then you're talking really a very large expense.
Are we talking thousands of dollars?
Yes. I mean, even for an apartment, the quotes often are around $1,000 to $1,200.
Wow.
And so so that's kind of the last ace in the hole. I'm not saying that you have to go to heat, but ultimately that's the one treatment I have the most faith in.
All right. Good luck with that, Shirley. That's really a horrible situation to be in. Let's go to Maya in Glendale next. Hi, Maya.
Hi.
Yes, Maya had to leave, but this is her husband.
Okay.
We had around Olympic times, we were watching television, and suddenly, I don't know how it got in the house in the fall, but there was a big bumblebee buzzing around the room, and it landed on our couch.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to throw it out because we knew it would freeze, so we put it in a large plastic container with a nice screen over the top, we've been feeding it sugar water. Now, the question is, what would be a safe time for it to be put outside?
So this is a queen. Only the queens overwinter.
Okay.
And it's very nice that you're taking care of her. But unfortunately, the way this spring is going, I'm thinking it's not going to be till 10th, 15th of April. I'm hopeful that it will be warm enough. Now, you can do her a favor a little bit by keeping her in a somewhat cooler condition because she's not going to be demanding as much energy. So, you know, it may be just fine to take her out and put her in the garage if it's unheated or whatnot. So it's somewhat protected, but yet it's not getting her all charged up thinking it's spring and the like. It's just hard to say. Since you've been feeding her, I'm suspicious that she may be a little too far along and you'll have to continue to try to keep her going that way. But as I said, with this weather, we need 55, 60 degrees for a couple, 3 days. And then I'd say, well, okay, that might be a time that you might consider letting her out. And as I said, from what I've seen of the forecast, it's going to be a while yet.
Uh-huh. It's full of energy. One of those large 66-quart plastic containers, and it's buzzing around or inside, flying around.
Okay. Yeah, well, then she's totally woken up. So as I said, I'm not so sure. Although, you know, it's interesting. What I will see on a warm spring day is you'll see some activity, then you get some cold weather, and they kind of just go dormant. They find a place to kind of crawl under and ride it out. And then take advantage of things, but it's just that the earlier they wake up, the more stress that they have before things finally get ready for them outdoors.
And Phil, will that queen find a hive?
Yeah, so much like the ground nesting yellow jackets, bumblebees like cavities. So typically they're finding, rodent burrows and the like to set up their nest. Some of them, I've seen them in old birdhouses, anything, again, that's kind of a protected, sheltered cavity is what bumblebees will utilize. She basically has to lay the first group of eggs. She has to care for them, feed them. That's one of the reasons they're so big, is she's got a lot of energy stored in her body. And then once those workers become adults, then they can go out and do the lion's share of collecting nectar and the like, and she kind of just stays at home and lays eggs and the like. So and the colonies will build up until, often 6-7 dozen bumblebees in the late summer. They're all females all summer long. In the fall, they finally develop males, and then those males will mate with the new queens, and then those are the queens that spend the winter. So it's a very fascinating life cycle. The only bee that we have here that spends the winter as a colony are honeybees.
Now, is there anything that we can buy a small beehive or something to put she can nest in when we put it outside?
Well, again, a little birdhouse might be, but I think you're going to have a hard time convincing her to stay there. You can try it, but as I said, typically you'll see them going around and kind of investigating things, old rock walls and whatnot, even if they've got the right place, sometimes it just doesn't trigger their response, but that's what she's looking for. So as I said, maybe the best thing to do is just buy an inexpensive little birdhouse and put her in that when things warm up a little bit, and just see if she takes advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks. Okay. Thanks for that, Colin. And what a wonderful story, taking care of that bumblebee.
Yes. And we have about 9 or 10 native species of bumblebees. There's a couple, three of the bumblebees in the United States that have been in the last 15 years, their populations have just crashed, which has caused some concern. Other ones are doing better, but there has been a shift. And then we have some exotic bumblebees here, too. I mean, it's really quite interesting. So there's more than one species. The Xerxes Society has got some good information on bumblebee conservation. And there's also a couple good websites people can pick up to help you identify the different species. It depends on the bands and the mm-hmm. coloration patterns and the like. And as I said, some are doing quite well. Some, unfortunately, are not.
And Xerxes is spelled X-E-R-X-E-S.
Yes.
Which is not how you might guess. So thanks so much for that call. There's a great photo from Ed on Facebook. He asks, is this a walking stick? It looked a little bit different, so I wondered. He saw it last fall, and he lives in Genoa City. And it looks like a walking stick.
It is a walking stick. Sometimes when they hold those antennae and the legs out and whatnot, they look kind of bizarre. We have four species of native walking sticks, although two of them are quite common, two are not. Typically find them more in oak forests because a lot of them are oak feeders and the like. And neat critters. We even have in the Baraboo Hills, once in a while, we'll have an outbreak where they're just absolutely everywhere. And then you can go 4 or 5 years and not find one.
All right. Thanks for that photo. Again, that's up on the Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones and Paulette in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Paulette.
Hi, Phil and Judy.
Hi.
My problem is a typical gardener's problem. I have slugs chewing on my hostas, and I've got a large area of hostas, and of course there's mulch in there. I understand that slugs love that. But there's so many hostas, I really can't do the beer in a bowl solution. And the rabbits and the slugs don't seem to chew on the hydrangeas that are in the same garden bed, but mm-hmm. they really just make a mess of the hostas. And is there anything I can do as the hostas come up, or, by the time they're fully grown in the summer, they're just shredded?
So, so much of this is influenced by moisture levels. You're probably watering when it gets dry, so it really doesn't matter. But generally, slugs like it wet and moist and don't like it dry. When you really get serious about slugs, they don't respond to insecticides, but there are commercial and over-the-counter slug baits that are sold. They're pelleted. They almost look like dog food. And you sprinkle them out, and honestly, when the slugs come in contact with them, it will kill them. And the one dilemma is that if it's raining a lot, the slug baits tend to break down and you have to reapply them. But that would be the ultimate, where we have serious commercial level type of problems. We have to go to the commercial slug baits that are out there. One product I know is called Deadline Bullets. There are other things. There's a bug getta and a slug getta that you can get at the garden stores and the like. There's an iron phosphate bait, pelleted bait also, that works reasonably well. So that would be the direction I would go. And slugs, although the books tell you overwinter as eggs, I find the first rock I turn over in the spring's got a big slug waiting there for you. So I guess I would say is try to be aggressive in May. I think that's when you can shut them down before you get much chance to get the next generation.
All right. Good luck with that, Paulette. And another garden question. Robin emailed, first said, congrats to Phil on retirement, but please don't let it take you away from Larry's show.
No, Dr. Craven and myself, I suspect, and Larry are all going to retire officially together from the radio. So hopefully that'll be many years to come.
Wow. And so you're going to be leaving a big hole then. Well, the question was from Robin, we have a good sized suburban lot on which I grow hundreds of types of perennials. We always have small ants that build nests / mounds all over the place. However, several times they've decided to build their mound right smack in the middle of one of my plants. And by the time I finally realized it, the plant had been nearly dead. Mm-hmm. Any ideas on how to discourage them?
Hard to discourage. They're from a group of ants that we call field ants. The colonies can live for 10 to 12 years. They take great offense if plants shade their nest, because it's a thermoregulation thing that they've got going. And even just the going back and forth can disturb it. And the name formica comes from the fact that they will inject formic acid into the roots of the plants if they don't like it. So they can, and this is unusual for ants, but they can be a plant pest. Once a nest is there, the only way I know how to control it is to get after the queen. And the trick seems to be is anything you put on the surface doesn't work because she's so far down in the ground. So what I tend to do is get some kind of probe, a metal bar or the like, and put two or three channels down into the ground as deep as I can, and then use whatever you're comfortable with as far as an ant product. Mix it up and drench it in so it soaks deep in, so I got a good chance of killing the queen. I think you can do that in a lot of cases without doing a lot of root disturbance. So as I said, it's kind of a spot treat, those problem ones. The ones that are other places, honestly, it's better to leave them be, because the good thing about field ants is their primary diet are insects. So they're eating pest insects that are on your plant. So there's a good side to their biology.
They're also aerating the soil with all those little tunnels.
Yes. So they, they're something that you should probably tolerate, but when it starts to get after your favorite plants, then, as I said, it will become life or death for the plants at times, and then I think it's worth spot treating.
Back to the phones, and James in Janesville. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you doing, Phil?
Good.
Yes, I have a question about pet mites. I heard you talking earlier. See, I live in this apartment building, and they have these cats and dogs, and I don't have a pet. And somehow I contracted these little tiny bugs to where they're so small where they almost like enter your pores, and they burrow down, and they lay eggs beneath your skin, and then they're feeding, and blood develops underneath the skin, and then when the sore comes to a head, then it's like a bunch of tiny, tiny little varmints come out.
What do you think, Phil?
I do not know any insect or mite that would fit that pattern. And so, as I said, if you're having skin irritation, I think it's worth going to the doctor and seeing if they can find out. But there are no critters. The only thing that's even remotely like that is that scabies mite, but it doesn't present quite the same. You don't get it from pets. You got to get it from other people. As I said, that being a medical problem, too, it's something you have to go. The only creature that I see, you can get fleas. Those would be big enough to see. They are very characteristic. They don't burrow into your skin. And the other one, there's a fur mite on pets that will bite people. Again, doesn't live in your body, but will cause reactions. On pets, it usually causes kind of a dandruff-type reaction. But then again, those both can be addressed on the pet and solved. And if you don't have pets in your immediate living environment, I wouldn't expect you to be exposed to those two things.
Thanks for that call, James. And on Facebook, David posted a couple pictures. He said it was found in a basement in Hurley, Wisconsin, along with the live one, which is about 2.5 to 3 inches long. There were many dead ones and spider webs in the ceiling, and it looks like some kind of millipede.
Centipede.
Centipede.
So this is a non-native centipede, but we find it indoors. So it's often called a house centipede because of that. It's a tropical species. It's a predator. Scary as heck as far as what it looks like. Relatively harmless, but they're creepy because they run around at night hunting food. You turn the light on, they run like the Dickens.
Well, and 3 inches long.
Yeah. And so I understand people's aversion to them. But so they're feeding on insects. So one of the arguments is if they're thriving, there's a lot of insects in the house. Mm. And what can you do to stop the insects so there's less food for the centipedes? I tend to find that probably one of the easiest ways of trying to help reduce them, not eliminate them, but reduce them, is using glue boards, which are these sticky, tacky pieces of cardboard that you can put back in the corners. If a centipede walks on it, it gets caught. And then they're rather slow to breed. And it's not like cockroaches that you can have 10,000 of them in, you know, 8 months type of thing. The numbers, there's, you don't see that. So if you see a lot of them, as I said, I go back to the point, there's a lot of clutter, there's a lot of insect feeding that they can feed on, and we try to adjust that part of it.
All right. We have time for one more call. Let's go to Lori in DeSoto. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I am calling about something I just noticed this morning. I started some seedlings for some flowers and vegetables and things about 3 or 4 weeks ago, so they're maybe an inch and a half high. And last night when I went to water them, I have them in, under grow lights, and when I went to water them, they had like little black fly kind of things buzzing around, little teeny tiny flies.
Okay, so I suspect they're fungus gnats, and those are little creatures that feed on organic matter in the soil, and then you see the little adult gnats. There's a bacterial insecticide that you can get. It's a form of BT, but it's one made specifically for killing flies. So it's as non-toxic as you can get. You just put it on the drench it on the soil. It goes down there. When the maggots feed on it, will kill. So that would be, you're going to have to go to a larger garden store to find this. Nat Out is one of the names I've seen it sold under. Natrol is another one, and I'm sure there's other products. So basically look for something for treating fungus gnats. And as I said, they won't hurt your plants typically, although once in a while, they'll do a little bit of root pruning.
Well, and these are seedlings that she's going to move outside eventually. So
right.
Would you recommend treating? Or
well,
or
the problem is how bad they get. I mean, they literally, because they kind of show up when you're watching TV and fly in your nose and type of things. I said they're a nuisance. It would be something, as I said, especially since you're going to probably have these plants for a number of weeks yet.
Yeah.
As I said, you might consider treating. So,
all right. Thanks for that, Lori. And we had an email from Mark. Are cellar spiders, those thin, long-legged spiders, becoming more common? Mm-hmm. We have spotted some in our home down in the basement where we have not had them in the past. They appear to reproduce very quickly. Is the vacuum cleaner the best way to control them?
Yeah, I think the vacuum cleaner is the best. These look like daddy long legs, but they have two body regions, and we're daddy long legs only have one. And it just depends if they move in an environment. You know, it can go in the same house hot and cold from year to year, but that is an environment that they like to be in, is quiet basements and the like.
They doing any harm?
No, I mean, you argue that they're beneficial because they're eating carpet beetles and ants and other things you probably don't want. But again, people have a hard time warming up to spiders generally, so I understand. And, you know, they do make some webbing and a little bit of a nuisance there. So,
and in just the last 30 seconds or so, you have an event coming up that we wanted to mention.
Yes, I'll be up in Minocqua on the 2nd of April at the Minocqua Brewing Company. This is sponsored by Kemp Station.
Phil.
Yes. See, this is what you get to do when you're retired. But we're going to be talking about ticks and tick-borne disease. And Tom Steele up there is sponsoring this. And so if anybody wants to talk about ticks, I'll be more than happy to chat with them on the 2nd of April.
And if people want to find out more details about time and things
6:30
that.
Yeah, 6:30 it starts.
Okay.
But again, check out the Kemp Station.
K-E-M-P.
Right.
Kemp, is it agricultural
station? Well, it is an agricultural station, but yes.
Okay. So. Great. It sounds like a fun event. Hopefully you won't get hit by an April 2nd blizzard up in...
Well, then I'll be a little slower coming home, so we'll see.
You could get some skiing in while you're up there. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Of course, we've always known that you were distinguished. And he recently retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, always a pleasure.
Nice to be here.
And coming up tomorrow at 11, we're going to learn the differences between different types of yoga and which one might be right for you. When we talk with the author of Pick Your Yoga Practice. And then tomorrow, coming up at 11:45, Rick Cini of FairCompare.com is here with great travel advice for the best time to pick your airline ticket purchases. sometimes it's too early, sometimes it's too late. Rick will tell us what that perfect window is. And then on Friday on Garden Talk, Ed Lyon from the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus will be with us to talk about specialty gardens. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us.